Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is evolution a settled question? Is intelligent design a science? And what do the impassioned arguments on either side bode for American culture and education? As part of a series of events inspired by the 150th anniversary of Charles Darwin's book On the Origin of Species, panel discussions at SMU are bringing together some of the key players in a 2005 federal district trial known officially as Kitzmiller v. Dover Area School District. The trouble started when the Dover School District ordered teachers to add intelligent design to the high school science curriculum, bringing long simmering debates over the teaching of evolution to a furious boil. Three of the panelists for the week's discussions are here now to talk about what happened. U.S. District Judge John Jones presided over Kitzmiller versus Dover. Lori Lebo is a Dover native and a journalist who wrote a book called The Devil in Dover, an insider story of dogma v. Darwin in small-town America. And Paula Apsell is senior executive producer for the PBS series Nova, which made a documentary film about the case called Judgment Day, Intelligent Design on Trial. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Great to be here.
We'll start with you, Lori. Can you tell us a little bit about what Dover is like?
Well, Dover's like a lot of small towns here in Texas as well. You know, there's a lot of wonderful things about Dover, and there's a lot of, not so nice things about Dover, just like any small town. What happened is, you know, people a lot of people know each other, and they tend to align on different sides. And that's certainly the case that played out here.
And there is one high school. Is that right? There's no sort of choice in even the region. Within the district, there's one high school.
Yes, they have one high school. It's a fairly small school. I think 2,600 students in the district. And
At what point after the school board made this decision about curriculum did parents decide to challenge the teaching of intelligent design?
Well, it started out as the school board wanted to they talked about teaching creationism 50-50 with evolution. And then that morphed into intelligent design. It was after the board adopted a statement that students would be made aware of this concept, intelligent design. It was actually put into the biology curriculum that 11 parents stood up and said, no, wait a minute, that's religion, and teaching religion is our right.
Paul, I think the film beautifully points out that in the modern world, regardless of what people might think should happen, we cannot separate science as a separate category from ethics or law or social culture. Can you talk, though, about why the team at Nova decided that what some people might look at as a legal story really worked in a show that focuses on science?
Well, I actually think that the trial was a gift for us because in many ways the trial itself was kind of a primer on evolution, a primer on evolutionary biology. And that's what was so unusual about it. It was not simply arguments that people were making with different opinions or what happened or disagreeing about things that had happened, but it was actually looking at the biology and asking the question about the veracity of Darwin's theory of evolution and the veracity of intelligent design. And it did that scientifically by actually examining the science and proving beyond a doubt that evolution is a fact and, quote, not just a theory. And because of the nature of the trial, which was so unusual, it just lent itself beautifully to ANOVA, which is focused much more on science than on social issues. So even though certain social and cultural issues were unavoidable in this, our program primarily was about the science of evolution. So it was totally suitable for ANOVA.
Let's go back for just a minute to this word theory, because that tends to trip up a lot of people. And in fact, it comes across that theory, according to scientists, means something very different than the way that a lot of people sort of use it in casual conversation.
Well, Ken Miller, who's a biologist from Brown University, made that point very strongly in the trial. You're right. Theory to some people means kind of a guess. And that's not what it means to scientists. When you have a theory, it means a collected set of facts that fit very well together, that have been thoroughly tested, and that is something that has worked its way into the scientific dogma, which means that other ideas are based upon it. I mean, gravity is really a theory, but I don't think that any of us sitting here with our feet held firmly to the ground are going to question it. So theory, in a way, is a way that scientists expressed fact, except in science, fact means something different. Fact always means something that we know until there is evidence to prove otherwise. And that's what science is. Science is a living course of study. Scientists always have to be prepared to change their minds. So science is, by its very nature, tentative. But even that means something different from what it means to our normal parlance, because it means that you can base a whole body of knowledge on this collection of facts, on this theory, and feel that you are as close to the truth as you can get at the time. So you're very correct. It does trip people up, but it doesn't mean a guess. It means something much, much more solid than that.
Now let's go to the legal questions. John, what were the things that you had to resolve in presiding over this case?
Well, first of all, when you have a challenge to an enactment like this by a school board, and there is a case that is built around a claim that it has violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, you have to decide, by applying some tests that have been handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States, what the purpose and the effect of the policy were. And put another way, in the context of this case, was the purpose of the policy religious? And to determine that, of course, you go back and you look at the whole panoply as the school board was meandering through the process that led them to adopt the policy. Well, it was pretty clear at the end of the day, after we heard the testimony, that in fact there was at bottom a religious purpose. But to measure the effect, you also had to look at what is intelligent design, because that was sort of the fulcrum of the policy. And to do that, you need to measure further, is intelligent design science? So there were a combination of things that we had to look at, the purpose obviously being one, as I said, but we had to look at scientific evidence and testimony and hear that testimony and consider that in the course of determining whether or not intelligent design constituted good science. Because if it did, which is what the school board said, and that it was valid and could be juxtaposed as they did with evolution, then that would tend to dovetail nicely with their argument that this was not a religious policy. Well, at the end of the day, of course, having heard all the scientific testimony, I came to a conclusion that was not that difficult to make, which was that intelligent design was not good science. So there were sort of two large areas that had to be determined.
Are you required in the same way that, say, a jury would be to keep yourself from looking at additional sources of information outside the trial?
Yeah, really, I am. And although I think for lawyers and judges, you can sort of unring the bell, it's not as antiseptic a process as it is with a jury. But that's a very good question, because a lot of people came to me in the ensuing years since the decision, and they've said, "Boy, I bet it was difficult to read up on this and to get yourself up to speed, and what sort of extrinsic materials did you have to help you?" And then they're startled when I say, "Well, none. I had everything that I needed within the case, and I had to hold myself to the same standards that I hold jurors, which is not to research or read up on a case. But I benefited, I will tell you, from the most marvelous experts from really all corners, particularly, obviously, on the plaintiff's side. And the case was sort of a magnificent way to go back and relearn things that I'd learned a long time ago, but to understand how far, for example, evolutionary theory has come since I learned it in the 70s in school. It was really remarkable. Margaret Talbot is a writer for The New Yorker, and she wrote an article in December of 2005, before I decided the case, actually. And she said, I think I'm paraphrasing, but she said something to the effect that the trial was like the science class that you wish you'd taken when you were in school. And that was a pretty good description of the scientific testimony as it unfolded. It was fascinating to see it.
Lori, there was also a personal component to all this for you. Within your own family, there was a great deal of disagreement over what was the right thing to believe.
Yes, it was in my case. One thing is that I also – I think everybody in the courtroom found the science that was being presented as fascinating. And as it continued, I was learning more and more about science. I mean, I had done a lot more homework going in. But so I became really drawn into what I was learning every day, racing into the courtroom. And I loved this. I found, I really was excited about it. However, people of fundamentalist Christian faiths believe that if you accept evolution, that you are going to hell, that you must believe in the literal truth of Genesis. That was the case with my father. My father was a born-again Christian, and I was witnessing not only the science that was being presented during the trial, but also the deception that was being done in the name of Jesus. The school board members very clearly lied. As a matter of fact, the judge recommended that they be investigated for perjury based on their testimony on the stand and in their depositions. And as well as the National Intelligent Design Movement, a very, very a lot of deception involved, and that came out during the trial. So that bothered me, and my father expected me to embrace this fundamentalist Christian belief. I wanted him to acknowledge that these people were lying for Jesus and basically mocking his faith with their lies. And so that became kind of a tough situation during the trial for me, and it caused some bad feelings.
At what point did creationism get sort of rebranded as intelligent design?
Well, I think I don't actually know the exact year. Maybe
1989?
Yeah.
So it was a specific point in time. It wasn't sort of something that happened gradually.
It was the U.S. Supreme Court's case of Edwards versus Aguillard, which was the test case for creation science.
Well, that shot down creation science, but then in its aftermath, in the aftermath of that case from the 80s, the sort of intelligent design movement, to use probably a bad word in the context of these interviews, evolved. And I'm not sure from my memory of the precise year, but the 80s would be an appropriate time frame. And as I said, in my opinion, at the end of the day, I found intelligent design to be nothing more than the sort of progeny, the successor to creationism and creation science. It was just a relabeling of what had gone on before. The sort of significant difference was that creation science admits to the existence of God. Intelligent design talked about supreme entity, but not
without a
God.
Label attached
without,
to
without
it.
God. Mm-hmm. Without God.
My guests are U.S. District Judge John Jones, Senior Executive Producer for Nova, Paula Apsell, and author Lori Lebo. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the 2005 Kitzmiller versus Dover case, which took the teaching of intelligent design out of public school curriculum in Dover, Pennsylvania. My guests this hour are U.S. District Judge John Jones, who decided the case, Paula Apsell, who's senior executive producer of NOVA and made a documentary called Judgment Day, Intelligent Design on Trial, and author Lori Lebo, whose book is called The Devil in Dover, an insider story of Dogma v. Darwin in Small Town America. All three are participating in a series of discussions at SMU over the next couple of days. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. And Paula, if you wanted to talk about the scene in the film where we sort of get to this rebranding.
Right. So this is about the, as John said, the evolution of creationism to intelligent design. And once the proponents of creationism understood that the courts were not going to allow them to teach creation science or creationism because it had been determined legally that this was a offshoot of religion, then they knew that they had to morph into something that would be more allowable. And one of the big issues in the case was intelligent design a form of science or was it simply religion in disguise? And one of the most powerful scenes, in my opinion, is when you see Barbara Forrest, who is a scholar who was asked by the attorneys for the plaintiff to go through these pages and pages. I think she said 70,000 pages or something, and she's sitting surrounded by all of these journals and magazines and publications that had come out from the opponents of evolution, and she had to go through them all. And finally, she finds in one of the articles the exact points at which creationism morphs into intelligent design, two exact duplicate articles. And in one of them, it uses the term creationism. In another, it uses the term intelligent design. And in fact, in some of them, a mistake had been made in the word processing, and it was kind of a combination of those two words. So as they said, that this was what opponents of evolution always claim is impossible, the transitional form, the missing link. You can actually see right in the show the missing link of how creationism turns into intelligent design. They called it a smoking gun. That was a very powerful scene in our show.
Was that a smoking gun moment for you?
There were several in the trial, but it was one of them. I wouldn't say that it was restricted to one. Barbara Forrest was a compelling witness because she was really a historian of the movement and has made this part of her life's work. And it was very interesting to me that the defense attempted to exclude her testimony because her expert report and her testimony was based on hearsay, which is allowable as long as it's reliable and in a certain context in federal courts. But she had accumulated, as Paula referred to, thousands of pages. And besides the issue of creation science morphing into intelligent design, she had these she had comments from the proponents and the architects of intelligent design that directly tied it to, I believe one of them said that it was a ground clearing operation for Christianity. So they had made some very overt religious statements to advocate for intelligent design. So the way I handled the objections is I said that she had to have available, the plaintiff's attorneys had to have available all of the resources, all of the journals, all of the documents that she was referring to that formed the sort of underpinning of her report, so that if the defense believed that she had misstated something or that she had taken something out of context, they were readily available. So they trucked all these things into the courtroom during her testimony. Not once during her testimony was there an objection that was based on the fact that she took something out of context or that she misstated something that these individuals had said, which I found very interesting and, as I said, added to sort of how compelling she was as a witness. Not only was she thorough, but she was accurate and she was good and one of the most remarkable witnesses, I think, in the trial.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Bonnie in Rockwall. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I just had a kind of an observation and a comment about if the whole issue was based on whether or not creationism, or in this case, intelligent design, was something representative of Christianity specifically. I'm guessing that that was the issue, the biggest issue, but maybe in general, just religion. It seems to me there are plenty of, you don't have to be a Christian to believe in intelligent design. And I also want to point out to listeners, and also maybe you can comment on this. It's my understanding that the Humanist Manifesto that was signed in the earlier part of this last century was founded and states that evolution is part of its religious belief system. And so one could actually equate evolution as a religion. There are still so many unknowns. It still takes quite a bit of faith, especially when we come down to the very bottom. Where did the first cell or where did the first germ writing on the backs of bacteria come from? So my observation is that I believe that both intelligent design, creation, and evolution require quite a bit of faith, and there are basically two sides. One side just doesn't want to acknowledge that they are a religion. However, it is filed away in the Congressional Library that humanism is a religion.
Bonnie, thank you so much for your call. Yeah, thanks very much for your call.
Well, if I can handle that, the caller's point is a point that I've heard before, and I would take issue with some of the with the essential premise of her point or her question. One of the areas that I think is problematic is when you say that evolution is a belief. Evolution is a scientific theory that is time-tested, is verifiable, and at a forum we had earlier today, Paula made the point, and I think it is so cogent and well stated that if anything, in the time since Darwin 150 years ago penned Origin of the Species, there has been abundant evidence, more evidence, that has supported evolution. So it's not a belief. It's not a religion, my view. Intelligent design may well be accepted by people who are not of faith. I don't question that. I had no, as I said sort of crudely, I had no dog in this hunt when I started the trial. I sat through 6 weeks of testimony. I gave intelligent design its opportunity through testimony to prove itself as science. It utterly failed, And whatever intelligent design is, whether it's a belief, I'm not sure. I would tend to think, based on everything that I heard, that intelligent design is a conclusion that is seeking evidence. And in fact, one of the leading proponents of intelligent design, Philip Johnson, who's a law professor from Berkeley, has said since the trial that it is not fully formed, and that the scientists that the movement has charged with sort of finding the evidence in support of intelligent design really have sort of failed, that they haven't come up with the necessary evidence. So, again, the caller sort of wants to do what the Dover School Board did, which is to juxtapose evolution and intelligent design, and I think that that's pretty dangerous territory in light of the Establishment Clause.
Well, one of the things that makes this argument so complicated and so interesting is the fact that there are faith traditions that don't have a problem with accepting scientifically tested theories, evolution being one, and there are many others, and they don't see that as in conflict with their belief in either a Christian God or any other sort of God. And there are other faith traditions that say, if you believe that evolution happened, it is impossible to believe in God. And that seems to me really makes this a very difficult sort of argument to have without people really seizing up on certain points.
Yes, and it's an argument that really is based on, it's not based on the reality of the facts. In fact, all mainstream religions accept both science and religion and don't have any problem. Catholicism, mainstream Protestant churches and certainly the Jewish religion, with the exception of some of the most extreme, extremely Orthodox, certainly have absolutely no problem with evolution. In fact, they see it as enhancing our appreciation of God's work. And so I think the kind of tragic thing behind this whole huge brouhaha that's erupted over evolution, and let's not forget that still, even after the Dover case, we're talking about polls that say that 48% of Americans do not accept evolution. The whole tragedy to me is the way in which it has created the appearance that science and religion are in opposition to each other. There are many scientists who are religious and who believe in God, and there are many who aren't. A belief in science says nothing about whether or not you believe in God. And there's no necessity for this kind of schism because it need not exist in reality.
One of the things that Ken Miller said during his testimony that I found so compelling is he said it was such a horrible thing to imagine that his daughter would have to choose between science and religion, and stressing that there doesn't have to be this conflict. Obviously, there are people of fundamentalist faiths who believe Genesis is the literal blueprint of how we got here. That is a conflict for them, but that certainly does not discount the reality that evolution occurs.
Was there part of you, Laura, you mentioned earlier that you were sort of excited about seeing this play out in court and seeing certain questions resolved, legally at least. Was there a part of you that thought, oh, God, but not in my town? I just don't want this to sort of have this kind of deleterious impact on how people get along with each other?
Well, I actually live just outside of Dover. I felt sad that there was this conflict with people in town. There were plenty of stories both in testimony, and both people told me about how, you know, after the end of the day, you walk your dog along the sidewalks of Dover, and people would used to wave to each other, but they stopped waving, they stopped hanging out in their backyards because they were ignoring each other. And Joel Leib, whose family roots go back to the Pennsylvania Dutch settlers from a William Penn land grant, his ancestors' tombstones are written in German. He said, you know, that it's created a divide in the community where there wasn't one before.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Adam in Fort Worth. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Wondering if your guest could comment on the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, because the movie seems to make the claim that creationism and intelligent design are very different. One of the reasons being that intelligent design does not require anything like a traditional theological concept of God. And so if you don't have a personal, loving, providential God that's required in creationism, how can intelligent design be creationism sort of repackaged?
Well, I saw that movie, and I have to say that it made me positively nauseous, because what the movie Expelled does and what its host, Ben Stein, I cannot imagine why somebody with Ben Stein's intelligence would ever take this perspective, is that it took some of the major evils of our world, including both Stalin, Hitler, and the concentration camps, and blamed them on evolutionary theory and Darwin. And I just have never or seldom seen in my life such a specious set of ideas, especially propelled into the public marketplace in a way that was so convoluted and so unfair and so just downright dishonest. So the idea of sitting on the train tracks outside of the Dachau concentration camp, which Ben Stein was with two of his other contributors, and chatting about how this place where Jews were killed was in any way related to the theory of evolution, I just find it unimaginable that people could be so dishonest in film, and it just made me sick.
I saw the film as well, and I share your feelings, and I also was just struck by all the amazing scientific talent that probably was eliminated in the concentration camps, and to blame that on Darwin, you know, was just appalling, I thought. But the one issue of intelligent design, the idea that intelligent design demands an intelligent designer, that is a supernatural idea. Now, you don't have to call that God, but it is a supernatural creator that we are talking about. And this, the problem with intelligent design, it's always that is always delivered with a nod and a wink. That is that who is the intelligent designer? I know that as a reporter, I kept trying to ask that over and over. Well, we don't know who the intelligent designer is. Well, obviously, there is a designer. There is a creator. And you cannot get past that when you're saying, well, we're not necessarily talking about God.
Well, and I agree with what both Laurie and Paula have said. And it's very unfortunate that Mr. Stein, who I had a pretty benign attitude and some respect for prior to the movie, chose to engage in pretty sloppy journalism and hyperbole. I know that he's smarter than that. And to the caller's other point, every major proponent of intelligent design, when pressed, including some in the trial under oath, when asked, who do you think the intelligent designer is, answered, I suppose to their credit and candidly, God. And they would say that. So, you know, and suppose it isn't God. It still invokes, as Laurie alluded to, the supernatural. And it's not testable. I can't investigate the supernatural. I can't. No one can. We haven't figured that out yet. So, again, that goes to my point that what we may have here is simply a conclusion seeking verification or seeking evidence, and it, as yet we don't have that.
We are talking about the teaching of evolution and intelligent design in public schools with U.S. District Judge John Jones, NOVA Senior Executive Producer Paula Apsell, and author Laurie Lebo. We'll be back in a minute, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are all participating in a series of events at SMU which commemorate the 150th anniversary of the publication of Charles Darwin's seminal work on the origin of species. U.S. District Judge John Jones is here. Paula Apsell is Senior Executive Producer for NOVA, which produced a documentary called Judgment Day, Intelligent Design on Trial. And Laurie Lebo is the author of a book called The Devil in Dover, an insider story of dogma v. Darwin in small-town America. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. John, you were recommended by Rick Santorum and appointed by President George W. Bush. A lot of people expected you, regardless of what took place in the trial, to make the call for the teaching of intelligent design.
Well, they did, and that's one of the larger lessons, I think, of the Kitzmiller versus Dover case, and one of the things that I speak about as I travel the country. And we really don't understand, as a country, how the third branch operates, which is my branch, the judiciary, and we don't understand the sort of workmanlike way that judges go about deciding cases. We decide them on precedent, as handed down by the higher courts, the Supreme Court, and on the facts as we find them. It's not a real sexy process. It's a standard operating procedure. I would like to think that any federal district judge in the country faced with the same facts as I found, or testimony that I base my facts on. And with the law being what it was then and still is, essentially, would have reached the same decision. Now, how they got there might have been different. They might have written in a more restricted way or an even broader way than I did. But at the end of the day, they would have found intelligent design, the teaching of intelligent design, unconstitutional. So I called it as I saw it, according to the law and the Constitution and the facts, without bias, without attempting to please a political benefactor, without favor to anybody. And that's the way the judiciary is supposed to work. So while it's interesting for people to note who my benefactors were, I think at the end of the day, what I tried to do was do what any good judge would do in the circumstances.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Kristen in Dallas. Hello, Kristen.
Hi. Thank you for the show, actually. This is piggybacking on a conversation my family just kind of had recently. My parents both were raised, my mother raised in the Deep South in Alabama in the 50s and 60s and 70s. My father raised here in Dallas. And when we were growing up, my parents would often comment, especially as we became teenagers, about this debate that required it to be faith versus evolution. They would often say that they didn't kind of understand where the debate came from, because all their lives, growing up in the various churches that the two of them attended, it was never an either-or argument. That within their own churches, that it was just accepted that evolution was a fact and that their faith was not in conflict with that. And they, even to this day, is the conversation we had the other day, they said, you know, we really don't know when faith hijacked, this is their quote, hijacked the evolutionary debate, because when they were growing up, only a fool would say you couldn't believe in both, to summarize. And I was just curious what your thoughts are about not only when this kind of started, but the fact that it's not something that's been going on, that's been going on while the debate's been there, is that it hasn't been an either-or forever,
yeah.
I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think that's part of the tragedy of our country right now, that that you know, we're in the midst of these culture wars, which just don't seem to go away. And I think that the argument over evolution and this artificial barrier between evolution, science, and religion is part of the culture wars, which is kept alive by a certain not just religious but political constituency for purposes that are much different from those of the narrow argument. And, you know, I think it's tragic. I think it's tragic for both science. I think it's really tragic for religion, because it, frankly, to ignore the scientific accomplishments. And we're not just talking about evolution here. We're talking about the Big Bang. And ultimately, we're talking about the whole scientific method, which is really responsible for so many of the benefits of living on Earth now in the 21st century, in medicine, in technology, the computers that we type on, the cell phones, everything. These are all based on science. And to turn your back on it is just, frankly, I think it makes people look foolish, and it kind of lowers the whole religious enterprise. And as the caller just said, it's entirely unnecessary, because there is no a priori split between believing in science and the scientific method and whatever your religious principles may be. As Stephen Jay Gould, the great scientist himself, said, they are two completely different magisteria. They are, you don't need to look at both of them through the same lens.
And remember, this is an enduring American debate. About 85 years ago in Dayton, Tennessee, we had the Scopes monkey trial, and it struck me during the Kitzmiller case that in many respects we hadn't changed that much in terms of the number of Americans who believe or disbelieve in evolution. So I'm not sure that there's been a hijacking for a long period of time after Scopes. You know, evolution wasn't taught. It simply wasn't touched upon, and it was really...
It was left out completely.
It was because of the controversy. And then, you know, you had the Sputnik period in the 50s that caused us to have this panic nationally that we were behind. And really, to Paula's point, when you talk about science, suddenly we realized that we were dumbing people down by not getting into some of the more intricate sciences, and then we started to teach it. Well, then that caused a succession of court cases through the 60s, starting with Epperson and some other cases that challenged some of the laws that really stayed on the books back dating to Scopes' time. That law remained on the books into the 60s after Scopes, little known. I mean, that wasn't the end of that. It stayed around, and evolution simply wasn't taught. So this is an enduring, interesting, uniquely—not uniquely American, because it does happen in other countries, but it's—
Strongly American.
It's strongly American, yeah.
Well, I think Paula is right, though, in the sense that it has always been here. Certainly goes back to the Scopes monkey trial, but it has gotten become a political movement. I think that's more of a more recent part of the battle that we're seeing, and as part of sort of an anti-intellectual kind of reaction. And I'm thinking of Don McElroy, who's on the Texas Board of Education and who was part of the movement to revamp the science curriculum down here, said not too long ago, somebody needs to stand up to the experts.
And I also think, I don't think that this is going to come to an end, if ever, but it won't until it hits us in our pocketbooks. And it is going to hit us in our pocketbooks, because we are in another pre-Sputnik era now, where the rest of the world is getting smarter and we are getting dumber. And our science education is either standing still or going down. And we are taking up our time arguing about this kind of foolishness, about whether evolution is a fact or not, and about whether it violates religious principles, instead of getting down to the business of teaching our kids science and helping them to become the scientists and engineers who are going to lay the foundation for our nation's competitiveness and our ability to compete with the rest of the world. And we are going to get poorer while others get richer if we don't wake up. And I hope that we will before the next generation does not do as well as we did. And I think that this is going to have direct implications. This isn't just some kind of argument that's unimportant. It is desperately important.
Does any one of the three of you think that your work on the case or covering the case has changed the mind of anybody who was solidly on the other side before?
I know that it has in some cases, and I'll give you an example. Ohio was having a debate right about the time that our case was being conducted, and they were very close to adopting a state policy that would have introduced intelligent design into the classrooms. And I do recall, although I can't remember her name, but a member of the State Board of Education switched her position after reading my decision, and she said, "I didn't understand what intelligent design was all about, and I get it. I understand this is an improvident policy. We ought not pass it," and they didn't, and the controversy passed. And I was heartened by that, because while my decision is not precedential outside Pennsylvania, I know that it's happened in other places, other school districts, and there have been other instances where good, thoughtful policymakers have taken the time to drill into it, not just to read my decision, but also to look at the evidence or lack thereof. As I joke with people, you know, a concept that is called intelligent design, it's like mom and apple pie. You know, you say, well, it has the word intelligent in it, it must be good. I think that these truly, and I'm being facetious, but these policymakers are being whipsawed without understanding what's at stake and what intelligent design is. And they simply rely on somebody say, well, there are scientists who are proponents of it. Well, therefore, we should teach both sides. That's a very glib description of evidence in favor of intelligent design. So, yeah, I think that we have probably changed some minds. A lot of minds, Perhaps not. I think that the dichotomy still exists in the United States today, the 48% or whatever it is. That's not my job. I didn't fancy that the opinion would have that broad of an effect. But I think that if policymakers are reading it and drilling further as a result of it, then that's probably a salutary benefit of the opinion.
We got a number of letters in response to our program, Judgment Day, Intelligent Design and Trial. And one particularly touched me. It was from a professor at Ohio State University who teaches freshman biology. And she said that at her school in the Midwest, kids come in from all different orientations and religious and backgrounds, and that this is usually a big sticking point for some of them. And she decided to show this program before she got to the unit on evolution. And she said that it completely raised the level of discussion, that kids started to really understand what the meaning of evidence was and started to be able to discuss evidence in the context of its importance to science as opposed to just something that seemed to contradict religion. And then the kicker for this was that we actually got a letter from a young man who had been one of those students. And he had been raised in an evangelical tradition and came into that class really, really opposed to evolution. And the program opened his mind. And while he certainly didn't say anything about giving up his religious beliefs, he said that his mind was completely open and that he could see the power and the beauty of the scientific idea of evolution, and that it really had changed his whole orientation toward science. So that was something that was really very rewarding. That doesn't happen every day, and it was great that it did.
What I get more of a response from people who've read my book. I probably get once a week I get an email from somebody who has read my book. Not so much that I might have changed their minds, but to say they connect with my story because they were also raised, they also have people they love dearly who are of fundamentalist faiths and who do fear for their eternal salvation, and how painful it is to be caught basically feeling responsible for somebody else's fear. And that's the response I get.
In the 30 seconds or so we have left, Lori, how is Dover doing now?
You know, the divide has, you know, Cindy Sneath, a good friend of mine who was one of the plaintiffs, always says, you know, nobody's minds in Dover really were changed. People are still on the same sides. But, you know, it's a small town. You got to get along. People still, now they eat in the same restaurants and they sort of nod their heads at each other and, you know, life goes on.
Lori Lebo is a journalist whose book is called The Devil in Dover, an insider story of dogma v. Darwin in small-town America. Paula Apsell is senior executive producer of Nova, which produced Judgment Day, Intelligent Design on Trial. And U.S. District Judge John Jones was the person who decided Kitzmiller versus Dover. Thank you all so much for being here this
afternoon.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.